In this episode of the Deming Institute podcast, Tim Higgins is our guest. Tim shares his compelling journey of using the teachings of Dr. Deming in his vocation and avocation. Hi, I'm Tripp Babbitt, host of the Deming Institute podcast. Our guest today is Tim Higgins. Welcome, Tim.
Well, good day. I'm not sure what time of the day it is when we're going to be listening to this. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss things that I've learned about Dr. Deming and his work.
Very good. So the first question I have for you, Tim, is related to, in your case, your vocation and avocation. Your vocation is that you work with Rocketdyne, and your avocation is this end-to-end thinking. Can you share a little bit with myself and the audience about types of things that you do in both those positions?
Yeah, at the Rocketdyne organization, I worked for them for 27 years. Then when I retired, I got a job with NASA to come back to the same facility and supervise the NASA contracts that Rocketdyne was working on, making rocket engines. And the guy that brought me in as a mission and safety assurance specialist told me my job was to make Rocketdyne a better contractor. So that gave me a lot of wide open opportunities. And with the end-to-end thinking organization, I was working with Bill Bellows and others for years. We formed a nonprofit in 2000 or so and started running a Deming-based conference on the West Coast. And we're about to run our 16th conference coming up here in June. In thinking takes the ideas of Deming and Taguchi and Tom Johnson and Edward de Bono and others and tries to integrate them into something that people can go use. In thinking is a term we developed. It's thinking about your own thinking. We're trying to help people become more aware of how they think, because they think in multiple ways, and each thinking mode they engage in creates certain behaviors. And most of the time, those behaviors get created because we're not paying attention to our thinking. I use an example sometimes of asking people if they, engineers especially, if they believe in prevention or in letting things run to fail. And a bunch of people raise their hands indicating they believe in prevention. And I say, how many of you with your hands up change your kitchen light bulbs before they burn out? Nobody does. Those are two different thinking modes, let things run to failure or prevent failure. And we automatically react. We let the kitchen light bulbs run to failure because it's not a big deal when they do, and replacing them is easy and quick. But we don't think about the fact that we unconsciously reacting to let it run to failure. On the other hand, not very many people would buy a car without a gas gauge, because the only time they know they were out of gas is when the car wasn't running. So okay. What we're trying to do is not change how people think, is make them aware of the different thinking modes so they can look at the context of their situation and say, given this is our context, what thinking mode should I be operating in, and make that a conscious decision rather than an accidental one.
Okay, very good. And this seems to be tied into kind of Dr. Deming and epistemology regards to that learning is individual and subjective. Is that kind of the approach that you're taking?
Absolutely. The people used to say, well, you're trying to change how we think. And I said, no, I don't want to change how you think. You think fine. I just want to make you aware of your thinking and how it affects your behavior. Because everything we do, all our behaviors, except for, you know, our livers operating and our stomachs dissolving our food, everything we do is based on a behavior that comes from thinking. And so if I help you examine what your thinking is, you can recognize what behaviors that will introduce. Deming used to say that a person will behave rationally given his perception of the situation. So if I see somebody acting in a way I think is irrational, instead of saying, well, he's crazy and what the hell's the matter with him, what I ought to be doing is saying, what is he seeing? What does he perceive differently from what I perceive? Because he's acting rationally given his perception. And so we believe everybody's acting rationally. We just want to help them understand the different ways they're thinking and how that's affecting their behaviors. And hopefully, using Dr. Deming and Taguchi and others as a basis, we can move forward. And I know in over the years, I've heard people say that Dr. Deming is about learning, or I'm sorry, about joy in work, or about variation reduction, or about all these things. And as near as I can tell, Dr. Deming was heavily involved in learning. Everything you want to do has to do with learning. What are you trying to learn? If you don't learn, you can't make an improvement. You are going to be doing what you've always done. So whatever you do, whether it's examining variation, trying to understand the system, whether you're engaged in a plan, do, study, activity, or whether you're looking at the psychology and how that affects people's behavior and the group's behavior, what you're trying to do is learn, and from that learning, make improvements.
Okay. Tim, when did you first come across the work of Dr. Deming?
I think it was the 1986 time frame. I had a friend who didn't work at Rocketdyne, and he was working with companies trying to help them learn how to manage their organizations better, and he was familiar with Deming's work, so he introduced it to me. And I think I started reading Out of the Crisis. I don't remember exactly the time frame. But then later, 1993 time frame, here at Rocketdyne, they created a total quality management office. And after it had been around a couple of years, I decided when they had an opening that maybe I ought to get into that. So I applied to the total quality management office and used some of my understanding of Deming to offer them what I could help them with in the total quality management office. And they hired me in, and I worked there, but clearly the organization figured out after 2 or 3 years they didn't need a total quality management office, so they disbanded us and sent us our separate ways. But during that time, I got to work with Bill Bellows and learn a lot. He was hired in as a Taguchi expert, so I learned a lot about Taguchi, but he also had a pretty good understanding of Deming's work, and so we started working together on trying to make things happen within the organization, which is were the roots of the Intuin Thinking organization that sprung from that after a few years.
Okay. And so as you were learning Dr. Deming's philosophy, and I like to call it that, you know, 14 points in the system, profound knowledge is more of a philosophy, at least in my mind. What were the types of things that maybe you struggled with most, or did it all kind of make sense to you from the very beginning?
It was interesting. For me, I knew I taught school for 8 years in the public school system, math and English at a high school, and I discovered whatever we were doing wasn't the right thing to be doing, and I could point out all the flaws, but I had no idea what we should be doing. I had no idea why what we were doing was screwed up. I just knew it was screwed up. And when I read the New Economics, some light bulbs started going on, some understanding of why we're in the mess we're in, and with Deming's help, figuring out what we could do to get out of it. I recognized grading was a stupid thing to be doing, but I didn't know how to get around it, get out of it, do something else. I recognized that deciding everybody was going to learn at the same rate was pretty crazy, and yet I didn't have a methodology for overcoming this system that was set up to do that. And as I read Deming, what I found is each time I went back to some of his words and started looking through it, I learned something I hadn't seen the first time through. I think I got a heck of a lot out of Dr. Deming. Starting in about 96, I started running the New Economics discussion series. What happened was I had a few folks around, 7 or 8 folks at Rocketdyne, and I said, how would you guys like to read this book and talk about it? They said, sure. So we spent a few weeks reading a little bit every day and meeting and talking about the book, and I learned a heck of a lot from that. And it was at least my second or third time through the book, and I was still seeing things. And I said, wow, that's fascinating. I can't believe I missed so many things. And then over the years, early, Bill Bellows said, well, why don't we make that a course that's part of what he called an in-thinking roadmap. The time big in industry were technology roadmaps, and Bill offered, well, technology roadmaps are a good thing. What about thinking and how we develop our thinking and increase our thinking abilities? So we developed a thinking roadmap, and part of the thinking roadmap became this New Economic Discussion Series. And I did it for a while just here at Rocketdyne, and then Bill said, why don't we open it up to the public and make it a phone call? I said, well, I never tried to do a discussion after reading a book on the phone, but we'll try it. We tried one, and it seemed to go well, so we kept going. And about three times a year, we run through that the new economics over 14 hours, 2 hours, 2 days a week for seven sessions. And I find it fascinating that even now, after 20 years of this, I find things that I didn't see before when I go through the book. And it's because as you learn and go out and apply what you learned, your lens changes. So when you go back and read the material, you see things that were invisible to you before. That's why I say Deming's about learning. It's continuing to learn. There's no end to it. It's a different model. The one we used to use in school is you learn, if time goes to the right on the chart and amount of knowledge gained or learning is the up and down axis, the y-axis, you've got this curve that starts off fairly steeply, and then as you reach a certain point, it starts to level off. And that's the mental model. So after you get to a certain point, things are leveled. There's no sense of going back to it. And yet the real learning curve looks absolutely different. It's more like a parabola. It starts at zero, and as you go to the right, your learning gets greater and greater and greater, and it keeps going. That's the reason why going back and taking a course after you think you've mastered something is so valuable, because you learn way more than you did the first time through.
Very interesting. As you're doing these new economic discussion groups, if you will, then what do people ask you about the most? What are the types of things that come up during the course of the discussion?
Well, typically the most frequent question is, why doesn't everybody get this?
Yeah, that's been around as long as Dr. Deming, huh?
That's an interesting question, and we could speculate, but even if we knew why they don't get it, how does that help us? What we need to do is help people get it. Go forward and spread the word. Why aren't they getting it? They perceive things differently. That's why they don't get it.
And the only solution is to help. Edward de Bono had a great line. He's the father of six thinking hats and lateral thinking. And Edward offers that when you're dealing with a difficulty of perception, logic is of no help. And so here you are dealing with a problem of perception, and you're looking for a logical explanation of why that's there so you can go make it go away. It's incompatible. You've probably seen the picture of what, when you look at the picture on the page, you might be able to see a vase, or you might be able to see, or two vases, or a vase in between a silhouette of two faces facing each other. So you have two black silhouettes, and you can see these two faces, and there's a, in the blank space in between, there's what looks like a vase. If somebody is looking at that and sees the silhouettes and can't see the vase, logic isn't going to help them see the vase. You have to find another way to help them see the vase. And it may be successful and it may not. But if they can see the vase, then the next step is, where do they go from there? Now I see things. The question is, are you going to do anything about what you've seen? In fact, Dr. Deming says, in essence, once your light bulb has gone on, once the individual has been transformed, he'll see all kinds of opportunities. and he can't unlearn. He will see the opportunities. Whether he decides to do anything about it is a whole other issue.
Right. You know, that's interesting, because one of the things that I do in some of the classes that I've taught is I'll take my index finger on my right hand, and I'll tell people to raise it, that index finger above their head, and rotate it in a clockwise fashion. And then I said, now, you know, lower it below your eye level. Now, which way is that index finger going? And invariably, it is counterclockwise. So perception is you know, different from your point of view, where you're looking. So I think that's interesting that you've caught on to that. What are some of the other things that are topics of discussion during the course of your group meetings?
I would offer the most difficult thing seems to be for people to grasp the issues associated with intrinsic motivation. A lot of folks seem to say, yeah, I get it, you know, we ought to work on on helping people do better, and certainly punishing them is a bad way to help them do better, but rewarding them is a good way. And it's difficult for people to grasp that whether you're rewarding a behavior or punishing a behavior, it's the same function. You're trying to manipulate their behavior. Alfie Cohn, who's cited in the New Economics, has some interesting things to say about that. He has a book called Punished by Rewards, where he calls grades and other things bribes. And he offers that when we're in the mode, whether it's punishing or rewarding individual behavior, the one that has the motivation isn't the person that you're rewarding, it's you. Your motivation is to get that person to behave in a different way. And that's different from leading them to discovery and letting them behave the way that they've discovered they ought to behave. And it's very hard to get people to recognize, even after they agree that internal motivation is very powerful, it's very hard to let go of that reward. Alfie Cohn says a teacher sees Billy eating a sandwich at lunchtime and Sally doesn't have a sandwich, so Billy looks at her and notices, and so he offers her half of his sandwich. And he says the teacher invariably cannot resist going over and telling Billy what a great thing he did. And what Alfie offers is Billy did it on his own without any outside motivation. Why would you think he wouldn't continue to do things like that? Why do you think you need to get involved? And he offers the danger of getting involved is now Billy is looking around and say, wow, that's pretty neat. People pat me on the head when I do this. See what else I can do to get patted on the head. So he's looking for opportunities to get patted on the head rather than, in the case where he started out internally motivated, helping Sally. And it's very different. Alfie said when his kids were younger, his daughter, 3 or 4 years old, would be running up to him with something, daddy, daddy, look what I drew. And he said he had to resist the temptation to treat her like a dog and give her a biscuit. Oh, my, you're a great artist. So he'd take her back into what she was doing when she created the piece that she was showing him. And he would ask questions like, wow, what was the hardest part of that for you? Wow. What kind of things were you thinking about when you were doing that? So now the person gets daddy's, the kid gets daddy's attention, which is part of what the kid's after, but also dad takes her back into the experience so she can go back and relive that experience and say, wow, when I do stuff, I feel excited and interested. It's a very different approach to making stuff happen.
As you've met in these groups, you've kind of find it, you know, it would seem, I don't know whether you're evaluating in as much as you're making people, as you said, making people aware of what their thinking is. It's almost, as I've traveled around globally, I found that especially Americans seem to be getting less curious around things than they used to be. And my belief, and I'd be interested in your view, is, you know, that we've kind of driven out the intrinsic motivation through kind of the reward systems that we have here in the States, especially. It's part of our culture.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and it dominates a whole bunch of things, but there's still basic human stuff around there. One of the things I tell people I find fascinating, because we get people from not-for-profit organizations like Goodwill. We get people from healthcare on the conversation. We get people from other countries. We get people in high-tech, government, city councils. Had people on the York, England City Council in one of the series. And it's very interesting and fascinating to me that we all work for the same organization. Even a not-for-profit company, I was talking to somebody and saying, hey, you know, why don't you share with us how you handle things? Because certainly since you're not-for-profit, you don't have to set up goals and objectives and hand out raises and rewards based on achieving the goals and objectives. And he says, no, that's exactly what we do. We divide the region up into districts, and then we set goals for each district, and then we try to drive people to achieve those goals. And so there's something fundamental about our perception of how we ought to run an organization. I try to help executives get an idea of the two ways they think about getting behaviors they'd like. And I ask them, what would you like for your kids? And typically answers are, well, you know, I'd like them to be contributors to the world around them, continuous learners. I'd like them to be contributors to the family. And they go through some things. I say, well, how do you make that happen? Well, you know, I try to lead by example, and I try to coach them and counsel them. So, okay, interesting. What would you like from your employees? And they get similar kind of answers. You know, I'd like them to contribute to the company. I'd like them to be learning and offering ideas and doing good things and et cetera, et cetera. And I said, so it's sort of the same thing you want for your kids. And I said, well, kind of, but it's different. I said, yeah. So, well, at home, you mentor and you coach and you counsel, and at work, you hand out punishments and rewards, the bonuses based on the performance. Why don't you at home hand out, rate and rank your kids and your wife and hand out the birthday presents and Christmas presents based on the ratings and rankings? They said, well, that'd be stupid. And besides, my wife would shoot me. I said, okay, so it's stupid in that context. But since you want the same thing from your employees, why don't you work on coaching and counseling and mentoring and leading by example?
That seems like an awful lot to unpack, especially for an executive. Do they seem to do they seem to take to that fairly well then, in your experience, or does it just take longer? Or
no, what tends to happen is they recognize something different's going on, but it doesn't change their behavior. They're now might be a little bit concerned. I worked for the vice president of quality for about 3 years, and it was interesting because I was on his staff, and I thought my job was to transform him. He thought my job was something else. But I remember they had his staff meetings were after lunch, and we came in after one lunch, and this was an interesting one because that week they were having a celebration because they do yearly awards of some sort, big awards, and they had a tent pitched on campus and probably 400 or 500, maybe 600 people in under there having a barbecue, and people were getting awards were getting handed out and that sort of stuff. Now there are 2,000 people at the facility and about 600 under there enjoying themselves and celebrating. So when we got to staff meeting, the VP comes in and he says, wow, what did you think about the celebration out there today? And the staff was offering comments. One of them said, you know, well, one of my guys got an award. It would have been nice for me to know he was going to get an award. I could have been there. I could have, you know, congratulated him and that sort of stuff. And the VP of quality says, wow, that's interesting. We could invite all of the managers, and then we'd only be excluding 1,600 people. I said, whoa, holy cow, where did that come from? But he was starting to get the idea that being exclusive by handing out rewards and treating people as special creates a lot of havoc in the organization. I talked to his secretary during secretary week, and she was pretty much devastated. And I said, Barbara, you know, what's up? And she said, I hate this admin of the year week. I hate all of what that goes on around that. And I said, well, I understand how it can be painful because they're selecting a few here and there. I said, but the only thing I can offer you is that they're not doing it out of malice. They just don't understand. And she looks at me and says, it hurts just the same.
So are there any other particular stories that stand out in your mind from your discussions that things that learnings that might be helpful to the audience?
Well, I do remember an interesting one coming out of I went into a conference room and a friend, John Bergstrom, had been here doing some work with folks. And on a flip chart, there was a statement that I thought, wow, that's a wonderful statement. And it said, the system we have is perfectly designed to get the results we're getting. And what I grabbed from that helped me work with some folks to grasp what we were talking about is that if you're getting a certain set of results and you don't like them, you need a different system. And instead of looking for a specific cause, what caused this, what caused that is that your gas mileage runs between 30 and 35. And this week it was 30. And next week it might be 35. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow it might be 32. And to get them to start understanding that whatever variation they're getting, if it's within a predictable range, you can't ask for more than that. If you want a different result, you need to change something fundamental in the system. And that recognizing that the system is generating the result has been useful in getting people to move away from looking for a cause and starting to look for designing a solution, which is a different approach.
Absolutely. Well, Tim, is there any clarification of anything that you've answered so far or anything that you wish I would have asked that I didn't as far as our discussion today?
I don't think so. I think that Dr. Deming offers an opportunity to a whole bunch of people who, as he says, are working under the prevailing style of management, which he sees as a prison, and these people are imprisoned. In fact, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard. When somebody offers me that he is going to empower me, my first reaction is, who the heck do you think you are? You have somehow the ability to give me or take away power. So I've got all the power I need. I can do what I want. I can leave your company. I can help your company. I can work against your company. You can't empower me. And the fact that you believe that you are like a king and can grant power and authority to people, that appalls me. You ought to recognize that the people already have the power and figure out how to generate them working together toward a common aim.
Absolutely. Very good. Well, Tim Higgins, we appreciate you being on the Deming Institute podcast today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I enjoyed it.